Welcome to an all-new episode of Get Lit with Leanna, the podcast. Join me as I sit down with a new guest author in each episode to discuss their books, careers, and everything in between. Today's episode is so much fun. I get to sit down with author Ashley Winstead, who wrote the new romance book, Fool Me Once, but you may recognize her as the author of the thriller book, In My Dreams, I Hold a Knife. I had the best time connecting with Ashley. We spoke about how she parlayed from thrillers to romance, why she loves writing romance books. And of course, we really got into the themes and the throes of this book and some of my favorite moments and some of the really important messages. But the best part is that she gave details about a sequel coming soon about Alexis. One thing I'll say though, a little caveat, a little warning, if you will, this podcast definitely gets into spoilers. So if you have not yet read the book, I highly recommend you pick it up and then click play on this podcast, just because like some key moments may get ruined for you and that would suck. So I really recommend you picking up the book and reading it before checking out this episode. And if you're joining us now after reading the book and just excited to hear this conversation, you're in for a serious treat. I had the absolute best time talking with Ashley and I can't wait for you to hear our conversation. So enjoy. Welcome, Ashley Winstead, to the podcast.
Hi, Leanne. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here. I adored this book and I have so many questions and so much to ask and tell you about, but I'm so happy that you're here and we get to do this. And like, even though you're in Texas, right? That's where you are right now. So you're in Texas. I'm in Canada. I'm in Montreal at the moment. Like, it's so nice that we could do this on a beautiful Sunday morning.
I know. It's such a joy.
Such a fun activity. But before we get into the book, because I have so many questions about the book, I need to know more about you because we were kind of just talking about this before we recorded, but you've had the busiest 2 years, I feel, out of like any author I have spoken to or will speak to, because you've literally put out like, well, by the summer, you will have put out 3 books in 2 years during a global pandemic. Yes. So can you just, before we talk about these books, can you tell me how you like started writing and then the timing of it all, like when COVID happened, if that derailed your plans? Like, I'm so curious about all of that.
Yeah, I love that question. And one of the things that's so interesting is, and I'll get more into this, but the way that it appears when the books are coming out versus like all the time that they were written, because what looks like a really short period of time between books is like, represents actually like years and years of writing that are just all hitting now. So it looks like I'm amazingly prolific, but it's really just like timing. But yeah, so I, like, I think a lot of writers have always written, was one of those nerdy kids who just was obsessed with language and would walk around my house repeating sentences to myself that I found beautiful. Yeah, that's what I did when I was like 7 years old. So cursed from an early age to want to try this. And so always my career path, I was super focused. I was going to be a writer. I was going to be a writer. You know, that's what I went to college to do, majored in English and creative writing. And then I thought my next path was going to be getting an MFA, because really the only real writers I'd been exposed to were like writer professors, you know, who all wrote like beautiful esoteric literary fiction and poetry. And of course they had all gotten their MFAs. So I thought that's how you do it. I applied to 12 MFA programs in my senior year of college, got rejected, roundly rejected from all of them, and took that at the age of 22 as the sign that this thing I had wanted to do my whole life was actually not the path for me. And that objective assessments of my writing said I just wasn't good enough. And that was like a bitter pill I had to swallow. So a lot of regrets that is how I read that at the time.
I'm sure.
So many regrets. I didn't write for a decade. So the next 10 years of my life, I went and did other things. I worked in the music business. I worked in the entertainment industry in Los Angeles. I went to grad school and got my PhD. So I like started to climb slowly back towards.
Yeah. Work, you know?
And it wasn't until I had defended my dissertation, had my PhD, that I looked at my life and I said, Ashley, you have like taught yourself a good work ethic with this PhD. Like essentially a dissertation is a book length manuscript just on a dry academic text. you know, big spirit dry. And I was like, if you can get up at 8 a.m. and work until midnight every day of your life and just grind, what if you tried to apply that to the thing you secretly love and are just afraid to start again, which is fiction? So I had to actually convince myself I was never going to ever show anyone what I wrote, and I was going to do it for pleasure, and it was just going to be for me. And that's how I started writing fiction again. And so it's actually been, I want to say, like maybe 5, going on 6 years since I've been writing fiction. But I think what that 10 years of not writing gave me was so much life experience, so many adventures, so many ideas. Because now that I am writing books and have found this thing that I was always meant to do, I just convinced myself otherwise, like it's pouring out of me.
Right.
Just one right after the other. So that kind of explains all these books. And I, every book I write is in a different genre so far.
Yes.
Very wild. Like the first book I ever wrote and queried and got my agent with is a contemporary YA fantasy. I know that will never see the light of day.
I was about to say, how have I not heard of this? But that makes sense.
Nope. It was just the book I got my agent with. And then later we decided, you know what, let's turn our attention somewhere else. Maybe this isn't good enough for, to put on sub. And so I started writing a thriller that would become In My Dreams, I Hold a Knife. And, it was the early pandemic. So I had sold Dreams in a 2-book deal. So I knew I'd write another thriller. And early pandemic, early 2020, you know, March, and I was looking ahead and already stressing so much about the release of Dreams, just everything to do with how are readers going to receive this, and you know, what is it going to be like to debut in a pandemic? Just so much. And my husband had also gone on a business trip to Australia. And he was supposed to be there for a few months he's a NASA mechanical engineer. So he's doing very cool, like, you know, space stuff, but just out in Australia. And it seemed like all the borders were closing very quickly. Yes. If you remember that part of the pandemic, everyone's like, I think this is very bad. Oh, it's getting even worse. Oh, all the borders are closing, you know, and I actually thought that he was going to be trapped outside the country. And I question mark when we would see each other again.
That's crazy. That's so scary to think about. And I've heard so many stories of people in very similar situations.
Yes. And so there was the stress was high at that period of time. And so what I needed just in my heart was to live in a world where, yeah, bad things happened, but there was overall, like, you know, in a Shakespearean sense, the comedic outlook in which, like, yes, things are going up and really, really down and it's a roller coaster, but in the end, like, everything is going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Like, it just this, and that's like the beautiful world. And I can talk a lot more about this because I have a lot of thoughts about romance and what it does for us.
Yeah.
But that is the beautiful world of the romance genre. I've been a lifelong romance reader. Mm-hmm. And so at that moment of the pandemic is kind of what triggered me to finally start writing a romance of my own.
I'm a big, as you know, romance girly. Like, I really don't venture out too much outside of the romance love story world. I do love myself a thriller here and there, but like, I'm not a thriller junkie or a mystery junkie. Like, that's just not my bag, but romance is really where, like, it's my bread and butter. I really adore it. So I'm so curious because I know that your first thriller did so well and people are really, like, highly anticipating your next one. So how different was it for you to, like, switch that off in your brain and be like, hey, no, we're not doing a bunch of twists. We're not doing mystery. We're not dropping hints. We're not doing the red herring thing. This is purely just going to be like a compelling fictional story with a ton of swoony romance and like a little bit of steam. Like, how did you, I feel like that's two different parts of a brain. And normally authors, from what I understand, like, can't do so much of both. And you clearly do, and you do it well.
Thank you first. That's so kind. And I love this question because it was so hard. Like I underestimated how hard it was going to be when I started writing. Cause I kind of thought a story is a story, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing if I wrote a romance that was like very fast paced and, you know, a little bit, one chapter hooks into the other. So it's like, maybe I can bring some of that and that could actually be kind of cool. No, it is fully a different beast, this genre. And I'm actually still learning. So there are things and parts of Fool Me Once that, you know, I think, especially around like the likability of characters and the flaws of characters that are a little more conventional in thrillers and a little less conventional in the romance genre. And so I'm still learning. I will be like very upfront.
No, that's awesome.
Still learning how to make characters likable. I know that says a lot of things about me that I should probably talk to my therapist about, but I'm still learning. But I will say part of me just like really wanted to do that in the romance genre purposefully anyway, but it is so much harder to write in a light comedic style for me than it is to write in a dramatic thriller style.
Really? That's so interesting. Because you would think that it's easier, like you would think the reverse. You would think that it's so much easier to write like a happy story than to write something like twisted where you're trying to cut. Like for me, when I'm reading thrillers, and I haven't read that many, as I've said, but I never understand how an author does it. Like, how do they strategically plant the right seeds at the right time to keep you hooked, to keep you guessing, to steer you one direction, then take you the other way? Like, to me, that seems so much more challenging.
I honestly think like drama is inherently hooky. So if you're writing a thriller and it's like, oh, some secret is revealed, or oh, someone's hinting at this thing, this backstory, that's like, that is built in. I find it so much harder to keep a reader that compelled and hooked when the stakes are ostensibly, like objectively lower, right?
Yes.
Because it's about two people falling in love.
Yes.
And the craft and writer challenge of making a reader just as hooked to find out, you know, what's going to happen the next day at work, basically.
Yeah.
As it is like, what's going to happen when the murderer says
for sure.
Like those, one is just like it's built in. The other, you are having to bring that from a craft level to the writing. And so that was an amazing challenge that I set for myself without really realizing I was doing it. And one thing that I did different in writing Fool Me Once was for the most part, my writing process is the exact same, like very rigid across books. But is I actually read my sister the chapters of Fool Me Once as I wrote them.
Oh.
I like pure Charles Dickens, Dickensian serial novel style. Like I read them out loud to her so I could see when she laughed or when she didn't. And I could hear the rhythm and the cadence and the pace out loud. And so it was like testing my material on an audience.
That's so interesting.
Yes. And it was so critical because I would write jokes, of course, in there's a lot of comedy in
a lot.
Yeah. It's very heavy on the calm part of the rom-com. So I was writing a lot of jokes and, you know, I'm reading it and kind of like eyeing her. And the ones that kind of fell flat, I was like, well, scratch, you know, I'd like highlight real quick and
wow. It's so, that's really, really, really something that I wasn't expecting to hear. In my real life, I work in communications, which I know you can relate to.
Yeah.
But I do work in one of the sectors I work in is stand-up comedy. So I'm around a lot of comedians and people that are obviously working in that field. And I didn't realize ever, it never dawned on me as much as I read books, like how important the cadence of reading a story out loud is. And the fact that you said that you've read this out loud to like test your material, the way that stand-up comedians will do these like pop-up shows to test their jokes before going on a big tour or a big festival, what have you. I never in my life made the parallel, the connection between those two. So that's so cool that you just said that, because it just like you put two parts of my life that I love that are so different and you just tied them together.
I love that. And I want to go ask like every rom-com author, like, do you do this too?
I would love to know.
Yeah, I'd love to know too.
That's
but my
so fun.
Poor sister has listened to this entire book like probably three times.
There are way worse things to have to re-listen to this. Like I could reread this easily. You don't have to twist my arm, you know, like, but that's very funny. So before we get into all my favorite parts of this book, I'm wondering if you could provide us, entertain us all with the brief elevator pitch of the book.
Fool Me Once is an enemies to lovers-esque second chance romance that follows Lee Stone, who is a young Austinite, and she's a communications professional at a female-led electric vehicle company. And she has finally been handed like her dream opportunity, which is the chance to work campaign for a green energy bill in Texas of all places. And so she's so excited until she finds out who the governor of Texas has hired to be her campaign partner. Turns out to be a man named Ben Latterman, hotshot lawyer moving back to Texas from California, who just so happens to be her ex-boyfriend, whose life she blew up and ruined 5 years ago. And so shenanigans ensue from there.
So good. There were so many parts of this book when I read the synopsis that were like calling my name. Obviously, one of them was the fact that she worked in comms, because as I just said, I work in comms. But the quite literal one that called my name is the fact that her name is Lee, because that's my nickname. So I was like, we're literally twins. But what I really loved about this book is the names that you chose for these characters. And I'm always so curious about like names, but where did the inspiration for these names come from? And like, do you picture them in your head and then put a name to them? Or do you have a name and then you like build them in your head? Like, how does that work? Like, I can only imagine like when you're naming a child, it's so hard, but like naming a person in a book that then all of these people are going to read and judge and consider and build up their own personas of, like, that's so much pressure.
It is. And I am obsessed with naming, so I think way too much about it.
Okay.
And I will say the characters in this book were like the easiest to name. Dreams, all the characters of Dreams, like that took me a long time, but I knew Lee's name from the beginning. What I always do with my writing is the characters come to me first, actually before ideas, before plots, before anything. I start to get a person who haunts me, like a person who something is going on with them, or I just envision them really clearly in my head. And so I saw Lee Stone stumbling out of a one night stand. So like that opening scene, like she I saw her so vividly. And actually, I knew I wanted her name to be Lee, because that to me, Lee is like a very cool name.
You know,
exactly. And I was like, short, clipped, cool. Like that's a cool girl's name. And so I knew I loved Lee, but I actually referred to her as Stoner. And yes, the original title of this book is Stoner. That's how we sold it. It was Stoner, with Stoner : a love story.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so that it was like all about Lee, all about this like flawed, messy character. And of course the powers that be, who know a lot more about selling romance books than I do.
Yeah.
That's not going to work. We're not going to sell many books called Stoner. People are not going to know that this is a romance.
Yeah.
So we changed the title. But so I think of her both as Lee, but also a lot as Stoner. And then Ben Latterman, I just have always been obsessed with the name Ben. And to me, it's a swoony hero's name. So that's been in my back. It's been in my back pocket for a while. As like, I hope I'm going to write a character that lives up to the name Ben. I love that name. And just everyone else, Alexis. I think I got a little bit Alexis from
Schitt's Creek. Okay, good. Because that's what I was picturing the entire time. I was literally reading the book and I was like, la, 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 like singing. Yeah.
Okay. Nothing makes me happier. And actually, this is a total spoiler, so you're getting this first. And I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this. So HarperCollins, like, don't
come
me.
From her.
But there's the second book in this series is Alexis's book. I know that is I probably shouldn't have said that, but here we go. I begged to name it a little bit Alexis.
I'm sure it's copyrighted though, is it not?
It is. Yes. Yeah. Oh, no, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
And I was just like, can we figure out some way and create
like a little bit instead of a little bit, like lil.
Exactly. Can we work around it?
Yeah.
Like, what can we do? And everyone was just like, no, just choose another name. But oh, I just got it so stuck in my head that there was
that's
like a
so
solid
good. So yeah. I need to now ask further questions about this because you just dropped a bomb on me. Yeah. But how far into the writing process are you with this book? Is it done? Like, tell me. It's done.
It is done and in you, the editing process.
You, my friend, are a machine. Like, no, like it's crazy because you have a book coming out in August. Like you're giving the people what they want.
I hope so.
You are.
I really hope so.
Oh my gosh.
I really hope so.
So back to the character of Lee, because I loved so much about her. And I think what I loved the most about her was that she was so flawed and complicated and not at all one-dimensional. And at times, like, you didn't want to like her, even though you did like her, which I know you said was intentional and part of your writing process. But I'm so curious about how you chose her profession and in the world that this book is set in, with everything about the electric vehicles and the all the pro environment stuff. Like, was that a passion of yours aside from this book? Like, I'm curious about all of that.
Yeah. So love this question so much. I think I'll like separate two parts, the setting and like what Lee does. I used to be a comms director for a policy or like policy, a nonprofit that focused on like creating policy change essentially. Okay. So it was based here in Houston, Texas, but like also offices in Washington and New York, and just really focus on US domestic policy, like progressive policy change.
Crazy.
Social justice, climate change. So I worked there for 5 years and it was also very research driven. So okay. I steeped myself in climate change research, in just social justice research, you know, sociology so much. And I both loved that job so much. I actually only very recently left it to become a full-time writer.
Oh, wow.
So it's been very recent. So I was like writing this book while living in that world.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Very similar to Lee's world. And one of the things that just really, really sparked my conviction that I wanted to write Lee as part of like the Texas political world is I was working behind the scenes on trying to get a bill passed in Texas. And out of all the states that I've been in that position, like trying to get a good bill passed, mm-hmm. Texas was the most bananas. Like, I can't talk about the things that happened, but things that are, you would think like, there's no way this is true. This belongs in a fiction novel. And if it did, wow. We would all tell the writer that it was like overwrought and too much, but it was like, this stuff was happening in real life. And I was looking at it and thinking to myself, this would make such an excellent political comedy. Like the things that are very real that are happening belong in a novel. And I became really convinced that there was potential there.
Yeah.
And I read Casey McQuiston's Red, White, and Royal Blue. Like obviously when it came out, I know, like life-changing.
Yeah.
I actually read it on a plane to DC to like go do work stuff. And when I got to the end of that book, mm-hmm. and there's that amazing scene of like triumph,
yes.
like, politically.
Yes.
I sobbed. Like I had the most cathartic experience because we were living in a world that was so different from the one that they had painted. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, absolutely, like, I need more of this. I need more books set like this. And so I had always had that seed in the back of my head, and being like a lifelong Democrat and progressive in a very red state here in mm-hmm. Texas, it's like this constant thing where you look around at everyone else and they're doing such great work and their whole lives are committed to like progress. And yet you're constantly beaten back by like regressive politics.
For sure.
So I wanted to give red state progressives, I guess, a cathartic political fantasy.
Yeah.
In this romance. And Casey McQuiston like set the bar for how you could do that.
It's so true. And when I was reading your book, there was so much of it that reminded me of Red, White, and Royal Blue. And I wasn't going to point blank ask you about Red, White, and Royal Blue, but now that you've brought it up, I just have to like tell you that so much of it gave me the same like satisfaction feeling and like the ending, like we could talk about it, that last speech that Lee gives at that press conference. It's so powerful and I could visualize it. Like a humongous part of me is dying for this book to get made into a movie because I just need to like see that one scene when she stands up for Dakota. I need to just see it with my eyes because the way I envisioned it is so powerful. But when you were writing that dialogue, like her speech that she was just ad-libbing, were you like emotional writing it? Like she, and can you divulge like what exactly the message of that speech is and why it was important for you to include it in the story?
Yeah. So I, once again, like I was very emotional writing both that press conference and the very end in the epilogue where she stands up and is giving her own opening campaign speech. Like I actually get chills just thinking about it for a lot of reasons. And one of them is like working in politics, you still see the absolute like hypocrisy and misogyny that is embedded in so much of politics.
Yeah.
Where the way that media, political pundits, voters, like I'll put it back on us too, the way we treat women in power versus men in power is just night and day. And so I have this, there are a lot of things going on in that first press conference scene that you mentioned where Lee's boss, Dakota, her affair with the governor of Texas has been outed and everyone is talking about it. All the media, it actually is a story that makes national news as it would.
Yeah.
And so Lee, who has been hounding reporters for years to pay attention to Dakota's work and all the amazing things she's doing, all of a sudden she can't, like everyone's blowing up her phone to talk about the scandal Dakota is involved in. And all the blame is on her, not the governor of Texas, but on her. And that's where the speculation is. And it's just a spectacle. And so what Lee has been tasked to do by Dakota, who is just like a true hero, if there's one character I've ever written who's a true hero, it's Dakota. And she is going to fall on her sword in this scene and resign. And so that her electric vehicle company can continue to do good things unmired by her reputation. Lee is supposed to go out on the podium and just announce her. And what she does instead, because she's Lee and she does risky things, lover or hater, is she decides that this is not right. And what she's going to do instead is take everyone to task for their treatment of Dakota, but also use it to spin into a conversation about the fact that no one is perfect. Everyone is flawed. This is just a part of being human. And the fact that we hold anyone, but most of all women, up to this impossible standard is just absolutely ridiculous. And it's a kind of fantasy that's harmful to everyone.
Amen. So, yes. Amen.
So that's that. And I was very emotional writing it. That was also a scene that I was trying to nail a lot of jokes. So it was like this, that's like fool me once to me in a nutshell, like trying to make a lot of jokes and also feeling very emotional on the
On
the other end.
No, that was a really great scene. And another one of my favorite scenes in the book. One thing I need to say about this book is that I went into it thinking that it was going to be purely like a pure romance where the story was not going to broaden much more than the two main characters' relationship. And I was in for such a surprise because this book is obviously, it's very clearly a romance, but it's so much bigger than that. And there's so many, as we've talked about already, like a million different major serious conversations that like actually make you think and are just so much more than just a love story. And one of those elements to the book, which you tackled honestly so perfectly, is grief. And Lee's coming to terms with the fact that her father has passed away after having a strange relationship with him. And the scene where she's visiting his grave at the cemetery was one of my favorites to read. And you could just grasp totally how cathartic her finally going and acknowledging him at the grave was. And I'm curious about why that was important for you to include in the story and have that storyline.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I love this question, the opportunity to talk about it. that is my favorite scene in the book. And when I think about things that I'm proud of as mm-hmm. a writer, I think about that scene. I first of all say that I don't think there's such a thing as romance that isn't tangled in all the other facets of who we are as people, like who you are when you meet and encounter like a potential significant other or in a romantic relationship. You are bringing your grief and your baggage and your conditioning and your family, like you're bringing all of that into. Mm-hmm. So I think a romance, in my opinion, has to tackle those things as well. And for Lee, the reason why she can't be good for Ben and to herself in a romantic relationship is because she has not come to terms with this grief,
right,
and with, you know, her substance use issues and with a lot of other things that are part of this book. And I think that is just so, rather than exceptional, so normal.
So normal.
I think that's all of us. And what I really want to do, if I did nothing else with Fool Me Once, is to write a main character who looked like my friends.
Yes.
Who like looked like the women I love, who are so ambitious and so imperfect and trying so hard, you mm-hmm. know, with like tender cores, but hard shells. Maybe I gravitate to a certain kind of woman. I don't know. But I just wanted to write a woman like that and not ignore any of those facets of her. But to talk about that scene specifically, you know, grief is something that I think a lot about just as a person. I've experienced a lot of loss in my life. And, mm-hmm. You know, I think to speak about like the thriller romance difference, when I write thrillers, I actually let myself like lean into those feelings in a way where I just sink into some sadness, mm-hmm. I guess, and that helps to fuel my writing. But when I write romance, I discovered through Fool Me Once, it's the same thing where I start to lean in and then I do what to me feels a lot harder, which is look for the hope, like look for the resilience, look right. for the ladder out of the dark pit. And what does that look like? And so for me, that scene where Lee is just laying on her father's grave, mm-hmm. speaking to his gravestone, because it's as close as she can get at this point. That is both like a low point, but also the ladder out of the grief.
Exactly. That's exactly how it felt as a reader. That was really the turning point.
Yep.
Yeah. It's also one of my favorite scenes in the book. So I had to ask about it because you could tell that it came from a real thought out place and an intentional place. And it was necessary for the storyline, but I was very curious about the reasoning behind. So I appreciate that answer. And that explains so much more. But now to like make things a little bit lighter, because we just talked about some more serious parts of this book, the romance aspect is so good. And as you know, I'm a huge trope queen. Like, give me all of the tropes when I read a book. And this book, as you already mentioned, is an enemies to lovers, a second chance romance, a workplace romance, a sex not love romance. Like, there's like a bet in there too, like a wager. Like, there's just so many tropes in here. So when you set out to write this, being it's like your first published romance, were you like, okay, I'm starving for the tropes, give me all of them? Like, what was the trope background outlining like?
Oh, you hit the nail on the head. Like, I am someone who just devours romance similarly, like love it. In fact, if you were to say like, you know, choose one genre for the rest of your life, I'd be like romance, no question. And so I was just like, I want to cram this book full of everything I love. So like forced proximity, workplace.
Yeah. Oh, forced proximity. How could I forget the forced proximity?
Only one bed, like everything that I just like kill for in the romances that I read. I was like, let's see if we can work this in organically to this plot. And it's kind of funny because I love tension. Tension is just like pretty much all I want to read and write about.
Yes.
Like there's absolutely a place for like sweet, low tension books, and like give that to me also. I want that too. But ooh, my bread and butter is tension. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's why Enemies to Lovers appeals to me. Though I think Fool Me Once, I guess, is technically more of a second chance than it is Enemies to Lovers.
Yes.
But it's got that, like,
it has it, because it's the banter. It's the fact that they reunited in a place where they hated each other, or so we thought they hated each other. Spoiler alert, Ben didn't hate her. But anyway, that's, you know, like, so it's the tension and the banter. So what was that like, right? Because there's so many friggin' laugh out loud moments and so many swoony moments. So when you were writing it, like, did you have all the dialogue in your head? Like, how were you writing out these scenes? Was a lot of editing going back? Like, I know you said you worked on it with your sister, but what was that like writing it?
Oh, it was so fun. I've never had more fun writing than writing this book. In fact, my husband, who eventually made it back from Australia.
So happy to hear. I was going to ask. Hope he's home.
No, he's still out there. No, I'm just kidding. who eventually made it back, and I was writing this book. He calls this book my cackle book because he walked into the room so many times where I was writing and I was laughing to myself out loud. And he was just like, you're nuts.
No, that's so good.
And so I just had so much fun writing this book. Whenever I write, it's a very, like, I'm envisioning it all in my head.
Yeah.
And so it's a very, it almost feels like translation. Like, how do I get this image down on paper? That's very hard.
Yeah.
And so I this has been rewritten so many times for the express purposes of punching up the dialogue, punching up the banter, because that is so important to me. Those are my favorite scenes.
Yeah, me too.
Books. Like, I almost, like, I love the first, like, 60% of every, like, Enemies to Lovers or Same. Will They, Won't
The build
They.
Up. The build
the
up.
The build up. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I actually, like, was thinking to myself when I started to write a romance, I was like, could I write an all build up romance? And, like, what would that look like? Obviously you can't do that. You need them to eventually get together.
Yeah.
But I had the thought, that's how much I love, like, the build up.
Well, you could tell that in this book because there's so much build up. Like, but the thing is, when I, at least in my opinion, when I'm reading a book that has, like, amazing, like, sexual tension and banter, it's like, I don't even need anything to happen yet because I'm so satisfied by what's going on. And that's exactly how I felt with this book. I was never like, okay, it's time. Like, come on. Like, I'm at this part of the book. Like, where the hell is, I was fully satisfied with what you were giving and what you were providing, that, like, I was never at a point where I was like, this is being dragged out. Like, the banter and the buildup was so perfect.
Literally, I can retire because that is the best compliment I have
Please
ever
don't retire.
Received.
Please don't.
But, like, that means the world to me because that's what I wanted to do so badly. And so this was like part of the thing where I would write these scenes. And of course, I love to, in my mind, I know that one character is saying, like, I love you and I hate that I love you, while they're, you know, like, slashing with these quips. And so I love, you know, trying to say, hint at that.
Yeah.
The reader. So it's just so many fun. There's always so many layers going on.
So many.
When you're in scenes like that. But yeah, those are the scenes especially where I, you know, would read them out loud multiple times to myself and to my sister.
Yeah.
And if she wasn't laughing, like, literally every other line, I feel like, nope, back to the drawing board. We're punching this up. We're making this sharper. Can it be even meaner? Can it be even, like, you know, quippier? Yeah. What can we do here?
And Ben is just like the ultimate cinnamon roll hero. Like, he's just so, like, swoony and perfect. And, like, I don't know, like, just everything after everything Lee put him through, the fact that he still was, like, so drawn to her and so in love with her and so understanding of, like, why she was the way she was, you just, like, really, like, drew him out perfectly. Like, I couldn't really picture him in terms of a face. I don't know why. Sometimes I have an amazing imagination where I can, like, put an actor to each person. But for some reason, Ben, like, in every, like, scene and in every scenario, like, he kind of just, like, looked different to me. Did he, like, did you have any, like, specifics in mind for him?
Yes, he looks like Henry Cavill, which I know in my head.
Oh my God.
But like young, scruffy, not built out Witcher Henry.
Okay.
Cavill.
Okay.
Not like has been to the gym for a million years. I'm talking like Tudors Henry.
Okay.
Cavill.
Okay. Oh my God.
You know,
love that for us.
Yes. And so that's how I picture him in my head. And he's actually, this is so fascinating to me because he is the one character I've ever fan cast in my head from the beginning as Henry Cavill. All of my other characters, I actually know generally what they look like, but like okay. Their faces are amorphous.
Yes. That's what I hear from a lot of authors. Like they have a general idea, but there's no like face.
And I think I've done a better job imparting physical description to readers with that weird amorphous face than I am when in my head it's like Henry Cavill doing everything.
Right.
So I think I need to like stick with the amorphous faces.
No, it's like, so good. It's so good.
He looks
good.
Like Henry Cavill. Okay, moving on to like other things that he's doing.
I love this book for so many reasons, but I really did love all the romance tropes aspects and like all of the swoony moments and the banter and everything just like made me adore it more. As much as I loved all of the other more serious sides to it, the romance was just chef's kiss. Definitely. So well done.
Thank you.
So good. My pleasure. My pleasure.
From you, an expert, that is everything.
Oh, please. Yeah. No, no. I try, but
you are.
Thank you. Thank you. Before I let you go, because tell us what else is going on. I know you said that you're writing or you've written already a sequel to this book, which is insane. But what else is going on? Is there anything you could tell us about The Last Housewife? Will you come back to talk about a thriller with me, even though I'm very romancey?
I will, but I don't think Last Housewife should be your thriller.
Oh, really?
I know this is not what you're supposed to do as an author. You're supposed to be like, yeah, totally. Please read my book. But if you're not if thrillers aren't like always your jam, The Last Housewife is like the darkest, most effed up thing that I've ever written. And is actually my editor, when she read it for the first time, was like, well, this gave me nightmares and I will never unread this, basically.
No, I have to read it. I have to read it now.
Well, I actually played with romance tropes in that book.
Okay, so.
In a dark way. Like all the things that I love about romance, I actually like looked at from a different perspective. Like some of the things that sometimes can be toxic, you know, that like, if done a certain way or toxic, I leaned into that.
Oh my God. Okay. I have to read it. The only other thriller that I've read that's given me like nightmares is Verity by Colleen Hoover. Have you read it?
I have not read it. I know that like my thriller card needs to be taken away for the fact that I haven't read it yet. But yeah, I know that's high on my list.
But the way that you're explaining The Last Housewife, how it's like a really dark thriller, but you play on romance aspects. Yeah. That's kind of what Verity was. And that's what drew me into Verity, because it still had like elements that I was familiar with, but it was a completely different ballgame. And that one gave me hella nightmares. So I feel like The Last Housewife is going to be the same situation.
I will never write a book without a strong central romance, because that's part of who I am as a person, what interests me. And I will say, I really can't talk about this one, but there is an upcoming project that I'm working on right now. And so much of it is it's not technically a dark romance, it's a thriller, but so much of it is like around this romantic relationship. And I'm so excited about this project.
Oh my God. Okay. So you're like the busiest human on earth. So I appreciate you taking the time to sit with me, because you have about 9,000 things on the go.
this was such a joy.
No, this was so much fun. I really love this book. I can't wait for everyone to have it in their hands and read it. And then I could talk about it freely with everybody that I love, because I feel like everyone's just going to adore it as much as I did. But I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me. I can't wait to read all of your other books, everything that's coming down the pipeline, especially the sequel. Like the fact that you divulged in this little secret is beyond. So I can't wait. I'm so excited.
Thank you so much. This is such an honor and a joy. I'm so excited. And I loved your first episode so much that I saw that's up. that I watched. You're just doing amazing things and appreciate you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you. This was so much fun. And I can't wait. We'll connect soon when The Last Housewife is out. And we'll
okay, perfect.
You may be my first thriller. It's possible.
Oh my gosh.
It'll be very fun.
I'm both excited and nervous about this one, I have to admit.
Yeah, it's gonna be so much fun. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.